Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August the 24th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, we're going to be listening to Dion Struthman. His subject, The Real Causes of Hunger, Access, Not Supply. Let's listen in.
My name is Dion Struthman. I'm from University of Minnesota. In the St. Paul campus, the agricultural part of the university campus in St. Paul. My responsibilities there in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics are to work on oat genetics and improvement. I'm particularly pleased to see that every morning for breakfast, there's either oatmeal or some oat products. And I have a very strong feeling about the fact that cream of wheat just doesn't cut it. The topic today relates to the first one that I led Tuesday evening. And perhaps in a number of ways, but the one that I'd like to stress has to do with the fact that ultimately I talked about using Professor Stoltz's suggestions to concentrate on the fall and the curses associated therewith. And then the six broken relationships, and in that particular session, the notion was that she suggested that we would perhaps expand the idea of Christology to include all six of the broken relationships occurring from the curses in the fall, not just the one of the relationships between God and humans. The six are animals in the earth, people on the earth, people and animals, and the one that I want to concentrate on today is among animals. What was another one? But the one I want to concentrate on today is among people, because it's my contention that the primary reason for hunger in the world today is because of the broken relationships among people. And hopefully I'll be able to spell that out for you, and that you will at least have an appreciation for what I'm trying to suggest, even if you don't totally agree with me at the end. I think that in by way of my background, one of the things that you should know is that soon after coming to the University of Minnesota in late 1966, by the next fall, 1967, I was involved in a project that has taken me to Mexico at least 1 week every year since. Now, I would not be able to give you any evidence of that if you were to ask me to do this in Spanish, because I couldn't do it. But I can assure you that I've been there. And in this regard, as we move into this topic, which ultimately can be summarized as the real cause of hunger is poverty and what all that entails, I can assure you that I've been in places where the kids, the pigs, and the dogs all use the same front door. Now, you can find perhaps places that might be even more descriptive of poverty, but I would suggest that when you get to the point where all three of those use the same front door, anything worse than that in terms of poverty is like the difference between 30 and 40 below zero in Minnesota in the wintertime. And both are cold, let me assure you. I've also had some experiences in Morocco, and there's a good chance that I'll be starting a new, perhaps long-term kind of involvement in several South American countries this fall. Those kinds of experiences have led me to totally reject the notion of supply-side food approaches or food supply-side approaches to the hunger problem, much as I totally reject the notion of supply-side economics to dealing with poverty. As far as I can see, both fail miserably, and basically for the same reason. Neither money nor food trickles very well. Let's see once. Before I get started on the topic, I was a late and somewhat uncertain addition to the teaching staff, so I did not get my suggestions to the bookstore. But I do have some exhibits that I'll share with you. In fact, if you want, this one went around the group the other night, and I'd be willing to do the same thing again. Let me just describe to you this particular publication, though, very briefly. The title is, How Much Land Can 10 Billion People Spare for Nature? And the argument made, basically, is one of supply-side approach to the total hunger situation. And the notion is that we're going to have 10 billion people, and so then what is it going to take to feed those 10 billion people? And in particular, what is it going to take if we don't want to take any more land, put any more land into production and out of nature? Okay? And so it's a very, if I would call it a very high-tech kind of approach to supplying as much food as possible. Now, I was the president of the organization that sponsored the publication of this book. And I will assure you that I tried to, in the editorial process, to change the tone of the book, but because the author is a member of the National Academy of Science, and I am not. I didn't have as much success as what I would have liked to. Anyway, my sense, among others, and in fact, the author of this book, Last Oasis Facing Water Scarcity, who was also a reviewer of the of this publication, both of us, I believe, could be categorized as firmly convinced that before we run out of food, in one sense, we will run out of water. And since water is an integral part of producing food, even if you were to take that kind of an approach, I would suggest that you would put at least considerable emphasis on water and not just food. But in fact, the whole notion of the supply thing for me is not where the whole thing's about. Yeah.
Who's the author of The Last Oasis?
Sander Postel. Sander Postel. Part of the World Watch group. In fact, I could show you a letter she wrote to the author in which I think it was five times she asked the author of this to sometimes in a nice way, sometimes in not such a nice way, please get in touch with reality. Let me give you, in one sense, the punchline. Well, let me go through the rest of this. Another thing that you might want to look for at some point is, this is the 1994 annual report of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And the title is, Who is My Neighbor? And it's a series of stories that would describe people that could be considered neighbors, and I think none of these people live within three blocks of me, so obviously that's a different kind of a neighbor. Well, let me give you the punchline of the whole thing as I see it in terms of this. The people at Compass Point Center in Seattle hosted Mother Teresa apparently a couple of years ago, and somebody asked her, according to Nyer, what she was going to do after she won the prize and so forth, and she said what her real mission in life was for the rich to get to know the poor. And my suggestion is that that's when we will solve the hunger problem. There's plenty of, it's a much better solution, for example, and it will accomplish much more relative to hunger than will increasing the current world's food supply by 10%. In fact, if we're not careful how we increase the current world's food supply by 10%, we might in fact actually exacerbate hunger. Because if we increase if we reduce the access to food in the sense of poverty, we will actually create more hunger. And many times when we try to increase the supply, what we do is to increase the poverty and therefore reduce the access to that. I'm going to today, as I was telling somebody a little bit earlier, in one sense, please don't accuse me of blasphemy, but this book right here, I'm going to read portions of it, sentences of it. Obviously, I'm going to, in one sense, take them out of context, but in another sense, they'll totally form their own context, and I won't be taking license with it. I want to accomplish two things today. One is to try to convince you that approaching the whole food situation, the hunger situation, by increasing the supply of food won't work. And the way I'm going to hopefully do that is by encouraging you to read this book. And so, in fact, at the risk of being blasphemous, I'm going to call this the Bible as far as hunger is concerned. And so I'm just going to read through some things here. And then we're going to have a little exercise at the end that will perhaps sort of bring all this into focus. Starts out, the importance of choices. Causes of hunger is about the conscious and often unconscious choices that we make. Choices we make as individuals and collective choices we make as consumers and as voters. Choices that may appear innocuous in their own right, but may contribute to the perpetuation of hunger, poverty, racism, and violence. Now, there's a number of examples here, but two of these that will, I think, one example is that more than three times as much is spent on tobacco products in this country as on foreign aid. And I think we have a senator from the state of North Carolina who would like to make that ratio even more in the wrong direction. A second thing, if you don't smoke, more is spent on household cleaning and polishing preparations, about 52 or 53 billion, than on federal contributions to education, training, and employment services, 43 billion. Since I'm an educator, that is particularly disgusting. Another excerpt. People are poor and hungry because they lack the power to be otherwise, in part because they are dominated by others who are more powerful. And as we go through the real causes of hunger, that will appear in several situations. Another way to describe a cause of hunger is that it's the lack of money to buy food and the lack of land to grow food are the most immediate causes of hunger. Moving on and going back to the broken relationships among people, discrimination takes many forms, but its core is dehumanization, treating people as less than fully human. Discriminatory beliefs, feelings, and practices make people just like us, humans with hopes and fears, failures and successes, into objects rather than living, breathing subjects. But, as I was suggesting in the Bible study this morning, I think that in any kind of assessment of this, where much of it is gloom and doom, one, in order to be most effective, really also has to offer some sense of hope so that people don't walk away thinking they're totally, at least people like us, walk away thinking that we're totally powerless. So here's another little thing that you should keep in mind. By the way, this was written in early 1995 or late 1994, just to give you some time frame. Since 1994, the number and proportion of chronically undernourished people who did not consume enough protein and calories in the developing world has fallen significantly. Now, there's other kinds of numbers that talks about proportion. If you talk about there's still reason to make sure that there's a problem. The intensity of those who are still hungry is probably worse than it's ever been. The first cause of hunger, and I don't think this is written in such a fashion so to suggest that these causes are necessarily in their importance. Although if you want to take it that way, it probably wouldn't be totally inappropriate or inaccurate. And I've already used one of the words, and the other one is politics. Both global and domestic. Hunger is not just about eating enough calories or having enough iodine in the diet. Fundamentally, hunger is a political question. Hungry people lack the power to end their hunger. The web that connects political power and hunger manifests itself globally and within nation states and communities. On the other end of the scale, 80% of the world's people have 15% of the income, which means that 20% of the world's people have 85% of the income. And particularly in this country, that gap is going in the wrong direction if we're trying to eliminate it. The right to food, and it seems that a number of the discussions in Washington these days in particular don't have to do with the rights to food, don't have to do with the need for food or aid, but more are focused on whether the recipients deserve it or not. Perhaps that's something we need to think about as well. It is paradoxical but hardly surprising that the right to food has been endorsed more often and with greater unanimity and urgency than most other human rights, while at the same time being violated more comprehensively and systematically than probably any other right. Somehow things... It's a little bit like going to a convention, and I don't mean to totally belittle this, but you go to some conventions and you pass a resolution, and then you go home and perhaps even forget about the resolution, but at least don't follow with any action that might be consistent with. The resolution is based, usually intended for other people to do something. And perhaps that's where the breakdown actually is. Who knows? The second one they list is militarism. And certainly those of us in this country should be able to relate to that in terms of how much money we spend ostensibly to keep ourselves safe and secure. But if you would in fact ask people today on the street whether they feel more safe and secure than they did 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, I would argue that the answer is such that they cannot conclude anything but the fact that they're not getting their money's worth. Yet, we continue to, even today, while we're trying to put the budget deficit into balance, we're still talking about, at least some people are, those who are presumably going to make the rules, of increasing the amount of money that will go to the military. A little bit of a side point in one sense, but we do talk about, on occasion, the war on hunger. And in fact, in the United Nations meeting of maybe 20 or so years ago, as I recall, it was Henry Kissinger and a few others maybe that talked about conducting a war on hunger, so that by a couple of years ago there should have no longer been any hunger. Within Christianity, the tradition of just wars stretches back to the 5th century. The criteria for a just war are quite vigorous. To be just, a war must have a just cause, be waged by a legitimate authority, be formally declared, be fought with peaceful intention, be a last resort, hold out for a reasonable hope of success, and be waged with means proportionate to the ends sought. I would suggest to you that with those criteria, the war on hunger is a just war. The third cause of hunger is poverty. It's going to be difficult before long, in some sense, to keep real good distinctions between these causes because they are not totally isolated situations. The quote here is that hunger is a symptom of poverty. If we can root out poverty, we can root out the systemic cause of hunger. And I will argue later that if anybody wants to deal with hunger, but they are not willing to deal with poverty, they are kidding themselves and perhaps playing cruel hoaxes on other folks. Recognize that worldwide, more than 1.3 billion people live on the equivalent of less than $1 per day. Set that sort of in some context. Also remember that from time to time, in the last 6 months or whenever, we've been arguing about whether or not we should raise the minimum wage in this country. It's now $4.50, I believe, an hour. And yet, a third, let's see, not a third, but approximately a fourth of the people in the world have less than a dollar a day, not even a dollar an hour. Again, the wealthiest one-fifth of the world's people control 85% of the income. And the poorest fifth, which is more than a billion people, in other words, 20%, the poorest people in the world, get 1.4% of the income. And just to make sure that everybody appreciates, poverty is not just in the rest of the world, and that the gap exists here as well. In 1980, the richest one-fifth of the U.S. households, so the richest 20%, got 39.9% of the total income. That's, they had twice as much of the income as their numbers. The poorest fifth had 5.3%. So the poorest 20% had only one-fourth of what their numbers would indicate. And that's a ratio of 7.5 to 1. 1992, just 12 years later, the ratio had widened. The top one-fifth had 41%. The bottom one-fifth only had 4.7%. And so the ratio in 12 years went from 7.5 to 1 to 8.9 to 1. And I don't believe it's narrowed since then either. No, I don't believe, I know that it hasn't. A little different topic. Sustainable development is defined differently by different people. Bread for the World Institute has come to define it in terms of four interconnected objectives: economic opportunity for poor people, meeting basic human needs, environmental protection, democratic participation. You may have your other definitions and so forth for sustainable development, but if we were to accomplish those four, I know that the world would be a better place to live in. Number four, consumption, population, and environment. And I'm going to focus on consumption because it is too tempting for those of us in the United States to focus on population, because then we can say that the problem is elsewhere. If, however, instead of talking about the numbers of people, we talk about the consumption equivalents, and that's in the sense of dealing with the capacity of the planet, that's what is a much more meaningful number, then we are much more a part of the problem. Much more a part of the problem. How much is enough? By Alan Turing. Consumption, the neglected god in the trinity of issues of the world, the neglected god in the trinity of issues the world must address if we are to get on a path of development that does not lead to ruin. The other two, population growth, technology change, receive attention. But with consumption, there is often only silence. The silence is not surprising. Breaking it requires that the richest one-fifth of the globe to question their own lifestyles, to challenge the all-pervasive notion that more is better. The reason is that consumption is a particularly important consideration is that overconsumption of non-renewable resources among relatively well-off people puts even more strain on the global environment than does, as I've suggested, the population growth among poor people. The industrial countries include 20% of the world's population. They consume 40% of its resources. The number, I think, for the United States relative to, let's say, a developing country like Bangladesh is that every newborn person in the United States will consume 40 times, on average, it could be either energy or resources generally, because they're roughly the same, as I understand it, as would this newborn baby in Bangladesh. So if we were to multiply the population of the United States by 40, then we put into much clearer comparison what we're talking about as far as stretching the capacity of the planet. But in case you are still wondering whether or not we have enough food, the world produces enough food for everyone to have 2,500 calories a day. This is current; these are current numbers, well, current last 6 months. That's 150 more than the basic minimum. So what that means is that right now we are about producing at least 7% more food, more calories, than what we need to feed everybody adequately. So if the food didn't change, we could still tolerate enough food production didn't change, we could still tolerate another 7% increase in population, and everybody would still have, if it was evenly distributed, an adequate enough amount of calories. Let me move on here.
Is that the grain production you're talking about?
All food. All the calories. All calories that are accessible as far as people are concerned. So it includes grain, but it would include meat, anything that people would ingest. And it's in the context of the number of calories, because that's the easiest way to...
The calorie of meat takes a lot more primary production than the calorie of grain does.
Mm, sure. It's part of the problem.
So you say the world produces enough calories right now, is that including the present meat production as well as the present grain production?
Yeah. Okay. And if we changed what we did about the meat, we'd have even more calories available. We ought to, in the process of looking at the, and this will be the tie between this session and the next session on sustainable agriculture. The United Nations estimates that 1/3 of the agricultural soil available in 1975 may be lost by the end of the century. So even if we just, use the same land boundaries to produce the food that we're talking about now, the topsoil, which is the part that's most productive by far, 1/3 of that in terms of the total world is going to be gone at the year 2000 based on what we had in 1975. And the tropical forest will have declined by half in the last 50 years from 1950 to the year 2000. Okay, another cause is racism. And you recognize that, again, some of these are interrelated. Racism and ethnocentrism underlie many situations of unequal access to the resources around the world. Hunger is a frequent result. Other ethnically based competition for resources leads to violent conflict. Another nose of hope. Yet countries such as Zimbabwe, Jamaica, and more recently the new order in South Africa offer a vision of multiracial democracy and food security. So again, even though this in many ways is a gloomy, solemn kind of topic and assessment, there are some places that we can look to for where things have actually turned out better, or and are in the process of doing so. Let me see, I'm going to skip over that one. Number six is gender discrimination. And that has its various forms in many parts of the world. Gender relationships, in some sense, come even more into play in terms of direct food production and food consumption than what they do in this country. But let me assure you, not very many places where the women get a break. And relating this back to population, Oscar Arias, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner several years ago, and also president of Costa Rica for a while, maybe still is, I'm not sure. Anyway, heard him say one night that let everybody understand that the best population control methodology in the world is education and economic development for the women of the world. When those two things happen, he argues that population control will take care of itself. Next one is age discrimination, and in this case what we have is a situation where both the young and the old are particularly vulnerable, and it's particularly sad. Well, in both cases it's sad, but in the case of children it's particularly sad, because in many cases when we have malnourishment and malnutrition of children at that early age, then many of the developmental aspects and the potential that they might have normally and healthily developed will never be realized. And so that we're talking about not only having people with more problems later on, but we're also talking about people's diminished capacity to contribute to the well-being of all of us. As well, the older people, and I've been going to a couple of the sessions of Jeff Dwyer and talking about the aging situation, healthcare, food situation, and so forth, and definitely people who are at risk. Okay, there are a number of people who are, and I never question their intentions, but I more and more, and this book totally questions their accomplishments with regard to food aid. When you see on the television people streaming in various places, trying to get from one place to another, trying to get to where food is from wherever they were and so forth. And we haven't seen too many of those pictures on television recently, but it wasn't all that long ago when we saw them. They're obviously the first reaction among a lot of us, and particularly church people, is to somehow get them food rather directly food situation. This book argues, and I think with good evidence, that most of the time, one, it doesn't really work relative to the amount of food that actually is moved around. It doesn't get distributed very well after it's located, so that, yes, some hunger is alleviated, but not as much as the amount of effort that goes into moving that food around. But more importantly than that, that what it does, most of the food aid in a more general sort of way, particularly, even if it's done well, many cases diminishes the incentives and the local production system to produce food. And so in the long run, maybe even in the intermediate run, it is totally counterproductive. You might be plugging the hole in the dike for a very short time in one sense, but very nearby, a much bigger hole is developing. And so the dilemma ultimately, in fact, is whether you prevent the starving of one person today, and then whether or not, because of consequences, implications, and so forth, you end up creating 5 or 10 starving people several years down the road. I'm going to make a couple more comments about the kind of relationship in this country politically between the food production situation, the farmers, and the poor people. And then I'm going to ask you to assume something that probably in one sense is totally unrealistic, but it will prove the point. I'm going to ask you to assume that you are the newly elected bishop of the church, and you will have just encountered some information that there's a new place in the world in which people are starving at very grievous numbers. And then at the same time, you will have just been presented some evidence in books like this and otherwise that direct food aid is not, probably not the best solution, or maybe not even any kind of a solution. And so I'll pose to you that dilemma, and you as the newly elected bishop, what will you urge the church to do in that kind of a situation? But before I do that, I want to just share with you a couple of other things that you would think, in some sense, that the food producers, and I consider myself one of these, so I'm not, when I'm reading this, I'm not being critical of somebody else, I'm being critical of myself and my peer group. But there's this sort of mystery, but I think this kind of describes why the relationship exists as it does. There's this notion that farmers really aren't very committed to dealing with the hunger problems in this country. In the 1980s, more attention may have been paid by farmers to poverty issues than in the past, especially in the Midwest. Yet despite work like that done in Iowa in the mid-1980s to sensitize farmers to the welfare needs and programs, some of that was probably done very much so by the ELCA and earlier the ALC, which is particularly prominent in Iowa. Most farmers' views of the poor seem to reflect a basic conservative ideology with overturns of tones of Calvinism that blames hunger on laziness or a defect in personality or behavior, and not economic and class structures. And I can tell you that growing up as a kid, I heard that in more than one version on any number of occasions. Not necessarily meant to be real mischievous in one sense, but still that sort of judgment being exercised on a number of occasions. Another aspect of this is something like the following. Oh, and by the way, you can talk about the rural poor, which is a major problem in this country. One of the other reasons that's related to this, why the farmers wouldn't necessarily relate to the rural poor, is that only 8% of the rural poor live on farms. So it's only 8% of those rural poor that they directly relate to. But here's another problem. When agricultural myths prevail, it is easy to perceive farmers as an undifferentiated collection of remarkably independent and unique individuals. Simultaneously, it is difficult to recognize small commercial producers as an easily manipulated source of cheap labor and cheap farm commodities for agribusiness. It is even more difficult to recognize that other populations share similar characteristics arising from their dependency on those who control capital and power. For example, labor, small businesses, minorities, and the poor. So we have, in some sense, a sort of disconnection between the farmers collectively and the poor people, even though, in one sense, the mission of, if you will, of farmers is to produce food, which would alleviate the hunger situation. On the other hand, you have, in fact, part of the whole agricultural production system and the industrialization of the agricultural production system of today actually creating much of the rural poor, in the sense that the structure as it is today in many ways has a very devastating effect on rural communities. And many of those rural poor used to live on farms, but they don't now. They might still live in rural situations and be poor, and or they are living in urban areas and are victimized there because they haven't been able to make the transition to that part of our society either.
Why do they used to live on farms, they don't anymore?
Well, because living on a farm, working on a farm, doing farming, is not totally by choice. There's a financial aspect to things, and if you can't compete, if you ultimately can't make the cash flow, you'll be forced off of the farm, and that's what's happened to many people. I need to be careful in all that because I left before I was forced off, in one sense, but all kinds of people in the late 50s, 60s, 70s from the Midwest moved west, further west, or went into other things, but left the rural community that they grew up in. Sometimes
so,
by choice.
Because of choice or because they...
Sometimes by choice, and sometimes it was forced. I mean, bankruptcies. Early 1980s, after the high interest rates came down and people had all kinds of debt in farms and so forth, and then the interest rate dropped and the prices of crops dropped and people just couldn't make the cash flow. And even with restructuring of the debts, in some cases slicing the interest rate in half, people still left the farms by droves.
The tractor replacing the horse had a much greater influence than people moving off the farm.
Perhaps, and I don't know the exact numbers. I think in the sense of relative to a particular time frame, I'd say no. I mean, we're talking about a major shift in terms of numbers within a 4 or 5 year period, whereas the tractors, the impact of the tractor, obviously, and not just the tractor, but it's the tractor, other kinds of machinery, chemicals, all of these things replacing labor.
One man can do the work of ten.
But again, I want to be careful where I'm at in all that, because I left the farm as well, and so I don't want to be critical of other people who want to substitute purchased inputs. I need to be very careful how I'm critical about people who want to substitute purchased inputs for labor, because I left the farm because the work relative to what I could see in terms of the future wasn't very attractive, and so I need to be very careful how I talk about other people who want to replace labor with capital kinds of things as well.
Well, Didn't the farmers expand too rapidly and borrow too much money? I mean,
sure.
For family farms, they had for centuries, so they're paid for.
Right.
So they became maybe not efficient or didn't have good manage or something. I mean, look at the Amish. I mean, they're farming horses yet today, and they appear to be fairly prosperous, perhaps buildings are painted and stuff like
that. Yeah. We'll talk about that tonight in the next session. And that relationship, I'll suggest, is between people and the earth, but also people and both plants and animals. And talking about that broken, two broken relationships relative to trying to sustain our production system, our food production system.
The other question had consumption. You mentioned before that right now there's just 7% or so more calories being produced than the world needs. But when the population of the world doubles, do we hope to double the production?
You see, we'll basically have to. If you believe the stuff that's in here, absolutely. Well, I don't, but lots of people do.
Well, what do you believe? Do you believe that we can double the production?
No, I'm telling you, I told you already that before we get to that point, we'll run out of water. And probably before we get to that point, we'll drown in our garbage. Unless we start doing things.
So you're saying the world cannot sustain doubling of the population?
Well, I think I'm going to be fortunate enough not to be around and have to live in a world that has...
That wasn't my question.
Yeah.
Are you saying it or not? I mean, this is pretty important.
I don't...
The world is heading towards doubling population. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. All the projections, the UN, et cetera, et cetera. Mostly in the third world, developing world, whatever you call it.
Well...
Do you think we can feed... Your title said that we could feed them. Is that true or not?
I'm saying that my title says that we can feed them today.
There's no way you're going to stop doubling the population in the world.
Oh.
Except by disease, war, famine, something like that.
I think that it is possible to stop the population explosion, and I didn't mention that, and the education of women. And the uplifting of the
economic development,
doing away with the gender discrimination that is across the world, and that's probably not going to be possible.
If you can change traditions and everything else in the world today, you're faced with over 8 billion people in the world. Every woman had a replacement level number of children, 2.1 children. They had over 8 billion before it led to stabilize. And the odds are you're not going to do that. So the 10 billion figure is a very realistic figure.
Well, unless
there's going to be widespread starvation.
Unless there's some intervening force that doesn't allow us to get to 10 billion. What I'm suggesting is there's several limits that will not likely let it happen, and certainly won't make it a very nice place to be. Go ahead.
A comment on water in the middle of the disaster area with Hurricane Andrew. It was water which was the most needed and the most anything. And it was just incredible what people would do for water and how little of it we have. That's like right after the Hurricane Andrew. And then the other thing though that bothers me is that just recently I saw on television all this stuff about how we're not supposed to let our kids smoke. And what really bothers me is how they whitewash everything with the tobacco industry when they know, in fact, it is an addicting drug. And how our capitalistic society has so outwhipped itself, and that we can talk forever about all these wonderful things about feeding the hungry. But when you talk capitalism and you talk profit, that's become our God. It's not dealing with hunger at all. Because I hear stories in Bellevue, hey, look, this guy's a winner. He's making $56,000 working for Microsoft. I mean, the whole value system is completely walking the other way. So I mean, I hear this, but it's turning me into a kind of doomsday person, because I'm looking at reality out there where I'm at in the world, and I see everybody going for the gold, and they're saying I'm the winner because I was smarter than everybody else. And then I think, hey, I lived through the disaster area where people were dying all the way around me, and I know what it's like to need water. So the whole thing just doesn't balance to me at all right now.
Let me give you a real quick story, and then I do want to at least have you spend 5 minutes anyway playing bishop. You can say that that's where it's at and so forth. I just encountered an individual that I'd met a couple years ago, and again met him a couple weeks ago. He's talking about an individual who he had, when he retired from running one of the hotel chains, he earned, I think it was $100,000 a month interest on the money that he got when he sold this hotel chain. Okay. He offered this other individual a free trip to Hawaii. The guy says, I don't need that free trip to Hawaii. He says, yeah, but I'd really like to give you the free trip to Hawaii. He says, because I have this money and I don't want to give it to my kids because they won't appreciate it. And the point simply is that he's got all this money, and now he's got a big problem. Big problem. When you go around and offer a total stranger, basically, but one that you've made a very quick judgment on, would be gracious, or would be thankful to you, or you think they would be, if you could get them to take the money to go on a trip to Hawaii. He's got a big problem.
From the point of consumption, I heard a UN person talking recently, made the comment that a billion poor Chinese is unfortunate. A billion rich Chinese will be a tragedy.
Absolutely.
And hell bent on as fast as they can.
In fact, that's what's happening to a great extent right now. Jonathan was telling me that the number's gone down a little bit in terms of our consumption, because the other parts of the world are picking up and trying to be like us. I thought I had it in here someplace, but if I did, it's escaped me. If one of the people in the world behave and consume like us, we will get to the end of the petroleum reserves 20 times faster than we're going to get to them now.
What will bring the coal then?
Pardon?
What use coal?
That's not going to last a year.
Oh, it lasts 100 years long, 100 times longer than oil.
At exponential consumption rates, which are what we are in right now, it's really a fallacy to think that we have a 700-year supply of coal. We really don't, if you start looking at how we consume it.
We all have this, they've got solar energy.
As they compare to coal to oil.
We have the possibility of alternative energy sources beyond the fossil fuel, whatever they are. In fact, for those of you, I know that some of you know Dean Freudenberger at the Lutheran Northwestern Seminary. He and I are trying to get a discussion going this fall, or probably, hopefully this fall, or early next spring, on agriculture and society generally in a post-petroleum era, because and there's a couple.